Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the shifting political sands as the Arab Spring sweeps the Middle East. Vali Nasser, who was until recently the senior advisor to President Obama's envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, joins us. Although the revolution of hope has tyrants toppling, Vali Nasser warns the Arab Spring could turn ugly as cornered despots resort to stirring up sectarian strife. Then we'll examine the political record of an emerging favorite amongst Republicans and some progressives, Ron Paul. Alternate's Washington editor Adele Stan joins us to explain why, if you're a member of an anti-woman, anti-gay, anti-black, anti-senior citizen, anti-equality, anti-education, pro-communist witch hunt wing of the progressive movement, then Ron Paul's your guy. Then finally, we will have a conversation with historian Michael Kazin about American Dreamers, his new book, which at a time when the American right is in ascendancy, provides a refreshing history of the American left that transformed both American society and the American soul, but since FDR has had a dismal record of progress in terms of political, social, and economic achievements. Let's now turn to the Middle East and the shifting sands as the Arab Spring brings forth hope, but our next guest suggests that it could also turn ugly. Joining us now is Vali Nasser, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of a New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
And clearly, if you look at what's happening recently with conflicting signals from the Iranian regime and from Hezbollah, it would seem that something is happening with Syria's biggest sponsor, which is Iran, having, I think, put up about $7 billion to keep the Assads in power. They've sent in the Revolutionary Guard Corps, al-Quds, to crack down on the Syrian opposition. But what gives here when the Iranian foreign minister is saying, well, maybe the Assads should talk to their people rather than crack heads and murder them? Does that say more about divisions within the Iran ruling elite, or is there a change of heart on the part of Iran and Hezbollah?
No, I don't think it says either one. It actually points to the fact that Iran understands that the Assad regime's tactics are not popular in the Arab world, and that the mood of the Arab world is not supportive of dictatorship and crackdowns and wants reform in Syria. And therefore, the Iranians understand that their very close support for the Assad regime is isolating them in the Arab world, and they are trying to distance themselves from being seen as being unequivocally supportive of a crackdown. So at the same time as they're supporting the Assad regime, they're also encouraging it to listen to its public. But that's more of a public relations statement, which is neither here nor there. It is directed not at the at the Assad government, but really at the Arab public.
So do you think the Arab public has such a short memory that they don't remember that the Arab Spring arguably began in Iran with the Green Movement that was brutally quashed by this very same regime in Tehran?
Well, they are hoping so. They are hoping that the Arab public will not be focused on Iran, but rather will be focused on developments in the Arab world. And Syria essentially is a very big challenge for Iran, because it's a case in which Iran's interest puts it at odds with the Arab public. It wants the Assad regime to survive. It wants it to get past this crisis. It wants the uprising in Syria to go away. But in the meantime, while the Assad government is busy killing people, the Iranian government finds itself increasingly at odds with the public opinion in the Arab world, and that's not a comfortable place for it.
So is there, given that some time back the Jordanian king warned about the Shiite crescent, because arguably the winner of the Iraq war was Iran, and you can tell by statements from Maliki recently in support of Syria where he stands, but it does seem that Iran is perhaps poised for a major setback there. Isn't it reasonable to assume that eventually the Assads will go?
Well, it is quite possible that there will be a profound change in the character of Syria. How soon this will happen, and in what manner this is going to happen, is still open to question. This could potentially take a year or two. It could end up with either a military coup at the top, or with the collapse of the regime, or ultimately, in the worst case scenario, with some kind of a civil war or civil conflict. And each of those will have its own impact. Governments around Syria, Iraq, Turkey are very worried about this outcome. So is Lebanon. And the Iranian also feel that the longer this protracted conflict goes on in Syria, the more Iran stands to lose.
Again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who is a professor at Tufts University. He served as senior advisor to the Obama administration, special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. In the article you wrote in Sunday's New York Times opinion section, If the Arab Spring Turns Ugly, you mention that already on the border between Iraq and Syria, there is tensions. And I take it there's a possibility, given the nature of that part of the world and the recent warfare there, that there's a possibility of a lot of weapons flowing from the Anbar Sunni part of Iraq into the Brotherhood, or whatever you choose to describe the Sunni majority.
Yes, and also, you know, there's all kinds of reports that the price of weapons on the Lebanese market has been going steadily up, and most of it is going in the direction of Syria. And also many in the Syrian opposition, particularly more on the extremist fringes of it, are looking at what happened in Libya and are arguing that, you know, in Libya, ultimately the opposition took up guns and resisted and challenged the Gaddafi regime militarily, and that potentially the opposition in Syria ought to do the same. But given the fact that the regime is using a very clear sectarian tact in its suppression of the protesters, that this may also end up taking a sectarian reaction. Even in Libya, you know, once the military resistance started, the tribal divisions in the country, the divisions between East and the West, between Benghazi and Tripoli, all of it came into play. And in Syria, when similar kinds of divisions come into play in any kind of a military challenge to the Assad regime, it will include not just tribal elements, but also sectarian divisions.
But Vali Nasser, aren't we dealing with something new here, in the sense that it's a pretty dismal choice between if you're a Syrian, and by the way, these people are incredibly brave in this nonviolent struggle, facing the military equipment of this vast killing machine led by the Alawite generals, and mostly the brother of Assad, Maha. But the choice is, if the choice is between Saudi Arabia, who's now condemning the Syrian regime, even though they are not famous for their human rights, and the Al-Quds, IRGC, Basij, you know, the clique that runs Iran at the moment, it's a pretty dismal choice. But isn't there something else going on here that goes all the way across the Middle East, from Tunisia through Egypt, and even in Israel now, the young people seem to be fed up with these regimes that as I think the refrain is, we want dignity. They're stealing our future.
Absolutely. I mean, this whole political upheaval in the region has started by populations refusing to accept things as they are, asking for accountability, asking for integrity, asking for a representative government, and more economic opportunity and better distribution of wealth in these societies. But the result of the of this popular challenge to these governments in the Arab world is to weaken the political structures that have also kept other kinds of conflicts in place. So, you know, in Syria, you have a minority that has enjoyed enormous amount of power and the better share of the wealth. The regime that protected this kind of a relationship is now teetering on the verge of collapse. And therefore, one of the things that has to be sorted out in the post-Assad regime is that the Alawites would lose resources, power, position to the majority population. And as we saw also in Iraq and we see in other cases, we saw in Bahrain, many the minorities that benefit from these regimes, even if they are unhappy about the regime behavior, are nevertheless they're not happy about losing their existing position and taking a back seat to the future. So, you know, the dynamic we have in this region right now is that the people and the people's movement and people's power is challenging the social and political structures that have been in place for decades. But those structures don't come undone easily. There is not always a soft landing. There are conflicts that have to be settled before you get to a much more peaceful and stable scenario. And that's exactly the dilemma in Syria.
But overlaying this whole area, which is what you've done in your Sunday article of Ali Nasser, where you have charts and graphs that show the Shiite Sunni division in all of these countries and the ratio of, in terms of population. Let's go through then the most likely fault lines, because there are many. Where things could turn into kind of sectarian strife, either spontaneously or as a result of the manipulation by cornered despots. Let's start with Lebanon, which has a Shiite majority, but the Hezbollah's some Hezbollah operatives have been just indicted by the UN trial into the murder of Hariri, of course, the prime minister, who was both a Sunni and a Saudi citizens, along with being the president of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. I mean, you know, the problematic of Lebanon is that it already had a simmering sectarian tension that started even before the Arab Spring. You've had, ever since the murder of Prime Minister Hariri in 2005, you've had this ongoing accusation that the country's largest Shia organization is responsible for murder of a popular Sunni prime minister. And then now you have the United Nations Tribunal, as of June of this year, formally indict Hezbollah members in the murder. And Hariri's murder and the subsequent clashes in Lebanon, the UN indictment, they all have polarized the politics of that country along those who support Hezbollah and its position, and those who are opposed to Hezbollah and believe that it has to be held accountable for Hariri's murder. Now, this division very neatly, by and large neatly, falls along a Sunni-Christian alliance vis-a-vis a Shia one. Now, many have viewed the Syrian regime as a critical piece of an Iran-Hezbollah alliance that is playing itself out in Lebanon. Now, that critical link is now under pressure because of the uprising in Syria, and at the same time that uprising is also pitting the Sunni majority in Syria against the Alawi minority. So, you know, Lebanon is both vulnerable to what's happening in Syria by the example of a Sunni Alawite clash, as well as the very fact that because of the very closeness of Syria to Lebanon, both geographically and politically, that it can very easily spill over into Lebanon. So, you know, you have the similar kinds of sectarian divisions. The one in Lebanon has been ongoing. It predates what happened in Syria. And what is happening in Syria may very well sort of be the straw that breaks the camel's back and forces a resolution to this standoff in Lebanon.
But could it also reignite the sectarian divide in Iraq? Because the Sunni, as we mentioned earlier, in the West, in Anbar, are supporting the Sunni majority who are being murdered by the Alawite regime in Syria, and yet their new government, which is heavily allied with Iran, is supporting the Assads.
It's quite possible. In other words, because across this region you have unresolved tensions between Shiites and Sunnis and a disgruntlement about the existing distribution of wealth and power, when you have a flashpoint in one country, it very easily can become an example for populations in other countries, and then therefore the conflict would begin to travel. There's also an issue of narratives. You see, the narrative of the Arab Spring is generally a narrative of democracy versus dictatorship, people's power versus political elites, accountability, integrity. The narrative that the Syrian government is trying to push is one of competition of power between minorities and majorities. And if this narrative in Syria begins to play out much more prominently, it would become a competitive narrative elsewhere also with the narrative of the Arab Spring. This is what we saw during the Iraq War, that the narrative that the United States had in mind, which is one of establishment of democracy in Iraq, was very quickly overwhelmed by the narrative of sectarian conflict. So there is an underlying tension in this region because of the unresolved sectarian issues that potentially, if you have a flare-up in one country, it could put on the table a very powerful narrative that then would begin to play itself out in other places. If Syria, for instance, begins to produce a very clear-cut conflict between Shiites and Sunnis, you're going to have populations across the Arab world take sides. So, you know, where would the Sunnis in the Gulf and Shiites in the Gulf, Sunnis in Iraq, Sunnis in Shiites in Iraq, whose side they would take, Sunnis in Lebanon, Shiites in Lebanon. So therefore, it has a potential to bring to the fore a very different narrative than the one that we're seeing, and if that and that's a big if, but if that comes to pass, then it could augur additional political tensions and conflicts in other places.
And of course, these conflicts go on all the time. They go on in Pakistan, where you have about a 15% minority of Shiites. They recently erupted in Bahrain, where Saudis helped suppress the Shiite majority. But you warn that could be radicalized now because they're being more repressed. And even within Saudi Arabia, where you've only got 15% minority of Shiites, you also have, I think, a kind of nascent Arab Spring there. And the Saudi regime is desperately trying to buy off the younger generation, but to buy off the younger generation, that means the price of oil has to stay high, right?
That's all true. I mean, in each of these countries, this conflict can take very different forms. I mean, in Pakistan, it's a sort of a state of bombing attacks and assassinations and kidnappings. In Bahrain, it took the form of massive street protests during that country's Arab Spring uprising. In Iraq, a lot of it is now taking the form of either bombing campaigns that are still ongoing, as well as a paralysis in the Iraqi parliament. And in Lebanon, we also see it right now reflected in the political paralysis in the country, but that can change and it can take a more violent tone. So, you know, in other words, in each of these countries, this is an evolving picture. It may take a different form in terms of how this will play out. And in the Gulf, it is true that the oil wealth helped douse enthusiasm for the Arab Spring, but also important was the specter of sectarian conflict. So, you know, when Bahrain erupted in a popular uprising, it was very clear that if it would have succeeded, that you would have had a diminishment of Sunni power in that country and empowerment of the Shias. And probably many in Saudi Arabia decided that they don't want to see that, and that reduced their enthusiasm for pushing for many more political reforms. So you know, you already had the sectarianism playing as a competitive narrative in the Gulf to that of the Arab Spring.
Well, just in closing here, Vali Nasser, it feels to me that the whole area is kind of booby-trapped in a way, on a precipice, and you've got this new force of demanding freedom and liberation coming from a younger generation who are not going to be satisfied with the old ways. So what's your final conclusion here?
No, I think what the young people are asking is very hopeful and is very important. But sometimes the path to democracy is not a straight path, as we saw, for instance, in a homogeneous country like Tunisia or Egypt, that when democracy challenges governments that have fossilized over a long period of time and an unjust relationship of power within their societies, that injustice also has to be worked out. So and sometimes that if there is not a very easy path for working that out, for instance, as South Africa did through a rather peaceful transition from minority to majority rule, you might go through a period of conflict like we saw in Iraq before things settled down. But the reality is that in most of the Middle East, you have very divided societies in which you don't have a homogeneous population. There is divisions not just by tribe, but also by sect and ethnicity. And dictatorships have not have protected certain imbalances. So, you know, the message of the youth is important, but what we have to understand is that there are hurdles in the road because of the nature of society and dictatorship in the Middle East, and therefore we have to watch for these and try to help this region get through this initial phase of settling these imbalances, so then it would have a clear run room to establish democracy and a much more just society.
I thank you for joining us here today, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break now, and we'll be back with Adele Stan giving us five reasons progressives should treat Ron Paul with extreme caution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article on alternet.org called Five Reasons Progressives Should Treat Ron Paul with Extreme Caution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And since you've asked here in your article if you're a member of the anti-woman, anti-gay, anti-black, anti-senior citizen, anti-equality, anti-education, pro-communist witch hunt wing of the progressive movement, Ron Paul is your guy. Any takers?
Well, you know, Ian, I so understand the hunger among progressives for a leader with some momentum who is against the building of American empire and overseas interventions, war, acts of war. I understand the hunger for a leader who is, you know, ready to pull the plug on the drug war conducted by the federal government that only seems to you know, increase the prison population and deaths by drugs. But Ron Paul is not the way to go. I mean, he's so not the way to go. I mean, Ron Paul is a friend of the John Birch Society. Now, I understand a lot of young people don't know what that is, but I urge people to familiarize themselves with the history of the John Birch Society, which, you know, Ron Paul is still doing presentations to the John Birch Society. I mean, these are the people who stood against the desegregation of our public schools. But, of course, Ron Paul's against public education pretty much, too, so...
Well, wasn't he the he was the keynote speaker, right,
at the 50th anniversary celebration of the John Birch Society.
Right. And he said some stuff there that was pretty disturbing, right? I mean, it had echoes of Rush Dooney's, you know, what's it called, that movement?
Reconstructionist
movement, yeah. What is his religiosity then? And you know,
well, you know, it's very difficult to discern. And here's one thing I do not begrudge Ron Paul. He is loath to talk about the particulars of his religious beliefs. And you know, I mean, I think that's fine. You know, I think that's in the great American tradition that you know there should be no religious test. However, the religious beliefs of a candidate, especially a religious candidate, can tell us a lot about their values and who they are. And the theology of the Christian Reconstructionist movement is long been intertwined with the ideology of the John Birch Society. In the case of the Birch Society, it's presented in a more secular, economic, libertarian kind of, you know, language, set of language. And when you get into Christian Reconstructionism, the rationale is more about this being God's law, as, you know, as the founder, Rush Dooney, interpreted the Hebrew Bible, which by the way, the stated the goal of Reconstructionism is to implement the law of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Bible, as the law of the land.
Sharia law for Christians, right?
Well, in a sense, yes.
Right.
In a sense. And I shouldn't say Christians, because it's a particular set of Christians. And, right. You know, there's a range of belief among Christians from, you know, very hard right to very, very progressive.
But that hasn't stopped Ron Paul from hiring Gary North, who's a Christian Reconstructionist leader and the son of the founder of Christian Reconstruction and the Constitutional Party, Rush Dooney.
Oh, I think, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there are very, very clear links and sympathies expressed by Paul to the Reconstructionist movement, and that would certainly be one. I mean, he hired Gary North as a staffer when Ron Paul was first elected to Congress in 1976. And Gary North didn't last long because he found the culture of Washington to be corrupt. And so he left. But he remains a supporter of Ron Paul, as does Howard Phillips, the Christian Reconstructionist who founded the Constitution Party, which is, you know, has a Christian Reconstructionist platform. You know, its mission is to restore God's law, in the law, you know, is consonant with the law of the Bible. So I think there's a lot to be concerned about.
But by the way, when Ron Paul finished his second presidential quest in 2008. When he dropped out, he didn't endorse John McCain or even the Libertarian Party nominee Bob Baer.
Right.
Bob Baer. He endorsed the Constitutional Party president Chuck Baldwin.
Right, Chuck Baldwin, and Chuck Baldwin is quite a character. He's a Baptist minister who travels in Reconstructionist circles, and his beliefs seem to be quite in line with theirs, with the exception of, you know, his interpretation of what's going to happen in the end times. Which meant that when he accepted the nomination of the Constitution Party, he made a big point of saying that he would be faithful to their platform. And Ron Paul, in 2008, also showed up at a pastor's forum conducted by Chuck Baldwin in Chuck Baldwin's church, Pensacola, Florida church. And at that event, I mean, you have Chuck Baldwin just effusively praising Ron Paul and Ron Paul's presidential candidacy, so I'm not sure how that all works out vis-a-vis tax law. And you also have an interesting exchange between Ron Paul and a congregant of Chuck Baldwin, in which you can see hints of sympathies with the Reconstructionist view of the end times and about the state of Israel. And I don't want to bog our conversation down with too much of the, you know, the vicissitudes and the nitty gritty of right wing theology and theological disputes. But there's plenty in Ron Paul's record of things that we know he said, or that we know were published under his name, to be concerned about. Just, you know, but I do think there's this mistaken belief that Ron Paul is this completely secular libertarian figure, when really I would call him a theo-libertarian.
Let's look at Adele Stand again, Alternet's bureau chief in Washington. She has an article at alternet.org called Five Reasons Progressives Should Treat Ron Paul with Extreme Caution. The reason I think a lot of people find him attractive is that he's a kind of like the Republicans' Dennis Kucinich, in as much as when you have all those stiffs up there running for president, just parroting the party line faithfully and rigidly, this guy throws all these bombshells, and distinctly makes them very uncomfortable, makes Fox News uncomfortable. They tried to disappear him by simply not reporting him. I mean, he almost won the Iowa straw poll.
And this week he's running number three ahead of Michelle Bachmann in the Gallup poll.
Well, there you go. I mean, they can't stop him, right? Something's happening out there, right? And what would happen, Adele, isn't there a possibility of a great irony here where the Republican Party could be the anti-war party?
Well, yes, there is. He is pushing the field that way. And it's important for progressives to understand where those views come from, and that when you look at the totality of the Ron Paul agenda, the ends may not justify the means. I certainly think they do not at all, because the Ron Paul agenda is really about disempowering anybody who doesn't already hold power, which includes, you know, women, blacks, gays, anybody who is outside of the majority, the white male majority. However, when you get into what Ron Paul's function is inside of the Republican Party, I mean, the Republican establishment at this point, in terms of its grip on power, is really greatly diminished. At this point, really what it owns is the infrastructure of nomination and of conducting campaigns, only to a certain degree, though. It no longer has the power to set the agenda because of the long view of the far right, starting in 1964 with the Barry Goldwater campaign, and continuously applying pressure to push the party to the right. And that involved taking over some of the levers of power at the local level, which gave them delegates and national conventions. And it also involved having a character like Ron Paul perpetually running for president, so that the rest of the field has to respond and move his way as, you know, his frustration with both government and with foreign intervention at a time of economic distress resonates with regular people.
Well, Adele Stand, I think you can see that the Republican Party is out of control, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the traditional kind of wing of the Republican Party thought it was a good idea to bring in the Christian evangelicals to Democrats use labor unions to walk the precincts and lick the stamps. They thought this was a great idea, but it's clearly backfired on them, as much as they don't control their own base, and Rick Perry's sort of running away with it, you know. know.
Well, the fact that the Bush crowd has not yet been able to stop Rick Perry, I think, is really because they don't like him. They're much more establishment, and they have not been able to stop him.
No, I think it is somewhat out of control. But how, given that Ron Paul has these libertarian trappings, if you will, and I don't know the extent to which it's real heartfelt ideology, but he did name his son Rand after Ayn Rand, who's the kind of poster girl or boy, really. I mean, if you listen to what she says, she's almost like, I'm really a man.
Right.
and man should do this, and man should do this, and man shouldn't do this, and man should only be out for man's self-interest, and altruism is a terrible thing. So given that Ayn Rand's number one disciple was Alan Greenspan, who Ron Paul clashed with in every time they had an opportunity in hearings throughout, you know, Greenspan's long tenure as the head of the Federal Reserve. So what's going on there? I mean, you would have thought that Ron Paul, if he likes Ayn Rand, would get on with Ayn Rand's number one disciple.
Yes, but Greenspan was co-opted by the establishment, you see. That is the way that Ron Paul would see that he's a sellout. I mean, just by virtue of accepting the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve, that would make Greenspan a sellout. In fact, there's a story that Ron Paul told in a speech that I watched online. It might have been the John Birch Society Gala, where he very victoriously, you know, he tells a story about how he had this article by Greenspan in an Ayn Randian publication called The Objectivist that was written in the 1960s, and he got the opportunity to meet with Greenspan when Greenspan was confirmed to the Federal Reserve, and he brought a copy of the magazine and had Greenspan sign the article, you know, autograph it for him, and, you know, asked him if he stood by what he wrote, and Greenspan said he did, but would not offer any any further elucidation on that fact. And of course, it was Greenspan who Ron Paul contends created the bubble, and I think there is, you know, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who would agree with that by keeping inflation artificially low. So there is just, you know, it's an intellectual dispute. And I think that to see Ron Paul as a traditional Ayn Rand type of libertarian is not quite on the money, because, I mean, she was completely atheist. And Ron Paul roots his ideology in his Christianity.
Well, just in closing, Adele, given that you've studied this 2008 keynote address that Ron Paul gave to the 50th anniversary gala of the John Birch Society, which was founded by candy magnate Robert Welch, but the co-founder, of course, is Fred Koch, the father of the Koch brothers, who are much in the news, both as supporters of, as exemplars of the new oligarchy, but also as kind of poster boys for all that ails America. Where does Ron Paul stand on American capitalism? Is he a Democrat or a plutocrat?
Ron Paul is not would not be a suitable candidate for the Kochs. I mean, you know, this is what happens as movements go along, of course, and disputes over power and its acquisition and how to maintain it arise, and you have different factions. And while their ideology may stem from a common source, I mean, there are differences there in that Ron Paul is not as pro-capitalist in the sense that the Kochs are. Well, not pro-corporate. He's much more against the government help for corporations, and there are differences. That's why Herman Cain is in the race. I mean, Herman Cain is basically the stand-in for the Coke business agenda, and he's there to push the field, toward the Coke business agenda, which is much more corporatist.
But boy, they picked a loser there, didn't they?
Idiot.
Yeah.
I got to say, I thought he would do better.
Right.
I mean, not necessarily in numbers, but at least in debates. I thought he'd be much
better. Right.
Happier.
Well, he's got the Sharia crowd. What can I say? I thank you for joining us here, Adele.
I'm sorry?
I said I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article on alternet.org called Five Reasons Progressives Should Treat Ron Paul with Extreme Caution. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with historian Michael Case. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Kazin, who is a professor of history at Georgetown University and the author of the new book, American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation. His other books include Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, and The Populist Persuasion in American History. He also co-edits Dissent magazine and writes a column for The New Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Kazin.
Well, thanks for having me.
And your book, American Dreamers, is much needed at this point, in as much as given that the American right is in ascendancy, it provides a refreshing history of the American left that transformed both American society and the American soul. Let's start with the paradox in America today. A small group of right-wing activists seem to have captured the Republican Party, captured the national agenda. The center seems to be insecure, ambivalent. The left seems completely mute, and the far left is incoherent. So where's the pushback going to come?
I think you kind of summed it up there. The left has to start putting together institutions and bolstering old ones and starting new ones, which really can evolve a lot of Americans, other than those who listen to KPFA and read The Nation and read Dissent and institutions like that. The problem, of course, is that the decline of labor and how defensive those unions will still exist are and have to be is a large part of the problem.
And also the lack of a
sense of alternative to what exists is part of the problem as well. So, the pushback has to begin, as it usually does, with ideas, with clearly stated, morally perceptive ways of talking to Americans.
By the way, I'm just going to interject that when you talk about American labor, they are furious with the Democratic Party, who've taken them for granted and taken all their money. And the Democrats' convention is going to be in North Carolina, and the hotels there are all non-union. I mean, talk about the Democrats being, brain dead.
Well, yeah, but of course the Democrats, as politicians always do, are responding to where the power seems to be, and unions don't seem to have much. When unions were powerful, the Democrats responded to them. I mean, that's sort of what Republicans are doing with their own base today.
Sure. Well, Michael Kazin, at this point, though, it would seem to me that the left, you know, apart from the fact that it's powerless, and then, and rather than you know, listen to Ron Rav Nader and Noam Chomsky until the cows come home, maybe it's time not to feel satisfied with rhetoric that makes you comfortable, but actually get out off your backsides and change America. Because if a bunch of right wing activists can capture the Republican Party, why can't a bunch of left wing activists capture the Democratic Party?
Well, I think in some ways that's true. I mean, people certainly. I've always thought, or have thought for a long time, that it made a lot more sense for people on the left to work, you know, as Democrats rather than to build their own parties. I think that's a dead end, and has usually been a dead end. You know, the problem there, of course, is that when it comes to election time, Democrats who are running for office try to get independence, try to get the center on their side. You know, we have to change the ideas of American society. I mean, in polls, twice as many people say they're conservatives as say they're liberals, and that doesn't mean that they're Tea Party people, but it means that they tend to gravitate towards arguments conservatives have been making for the last 30 years or so. And you know, we have to change that. That wasn't always true. That wasn't true in the 60s. It wasn't true in the 30s or 40s when more liberal ideas were in the ascendancy. And that's work that the left has to get involved. Has to convince Americans. And until we start doing that, Democrats are going to be opportunists.
Well, at this point, though,
politicians always are.
But at this point, I don't know about the Democrats, but at least the political left, and the one that I'm familiar with here at Pacifica, seems to have lost all sense of human rights. They seem to be enthralled and enamored by dictators like Gaddafi and Mugabe and Chavez. Well, Chavez wants to be a dictator, but he's not able to be sufficiently. But certainly they're completely in love with Castro, who, you know, jails all of my friends, at least the equivalent of my friends over there. You know, how can you – I don't see it as a political issue. I think it's a moral issue that mm-hmm. how can you support these dictators who, in varying degrees, particularly with Gaddafi, who's just absolutely monstrous, but they imprison their people, they stifle dissent, they steal the future of the young. That's why the Arab Spring is erupting. And they jail poets, thought thinkers, writers, journalists, the kind of people that I admire. I mean, I just find it morally reprehensible.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, there's, I read this in the book. There's a chapter on the American Communist Party, for example, where I talk about the great paradox that the American Communist Party was, of course, following after Stalin, one of the worst dictators in history, and in some ways, some American leftists now, I don't think a majority, are emulating that bad side of left-wing tradition. On the other hand, you know, the communists, some of them at least, were very involved in civil rights and labor unions and democratizing American culture more generally. I mean, you played If I Had a Hammer, you know, the Pete Seeger song earlier as an intro to this section. Bob Dylan, of course, got his start, for example, listening to folk music at left-wing coffee houses in Minneapolis. So, you know, I think you know, to the extent that left-wingers see anybody who's opposed to American foreign policy as being on their side, which is something that Noam Chomsky has done for many years, that's a real mistake. Sometimes those folks are right, but often, especially since the end of the Cold War, they're just tyrants over their own people. I agree with you there.
Well, you know, Denis Kucinich was recently hanging out with Assad at the time when Assad's murdering his own people. Denis Kucinich is there, you know, talking to him as though he was a legitimate leader and somebody that you could break bread with and hang out with. At the same time, impeaching Obama for getting involved in Libya and going on about bombing Libya, but no concept about how these dictatorships are murdering their own people and how their own people, defenseless own people, have to rise up and do what they can to remove them. No support there from Kucinich in terms of and by the way, these revolutions in Libya and in particularly in Syria are working class revolutions. They started in the poorest neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, we in my magazine, Dissent, if you look at our website, dissentmagazine.org, you can see a lot of sympathetic, though, you know, sometimes critical support for the Arab Spring, what's going on. And we had a debate about what the U.S. should do, to support the Libyan rebels. But clearly, you know, we, like most morally alert people around the world, are hoping for, you know, a democratic, somewhat more tolerant society.
Well, conversely,
throughout the Arab world as well.
But conversely, the mail I get from the Pacifica left is, you know, the Al Qaeda's taking over. It's all NATO's fault. And you know, essentially that they're all apologists for Gaddafi. That's the part that I find astounding.
Well,
that these guys are crony capitalists. If you're against the Koch brothers, for God's sake, here in the United States, how could you be in favor of the Assads and the Gaddafis?
Gaddafi is out of power now, and he's not going to come back. He's likely to be captured soon. So,
Fortunately,
that is not an argument we have to be having much anymore.
But what happened then, Michael Kazin? Again, the historian Michael Kazin, author of the new book American Dreamers: How the Left Changed a Nation. Much of the earlier progress in terms of civil rights, human rights, women's rights, workers' rights, came out of a religious conviction, which also ended slavery as well. And you've written about William Jennings Bryan, who, you know, arguably were in a new Gilded Age, and he was massively outspent by the plutocrats in the last Gilded Age, almost won. But in those days, there was a religious left. Did the new left make a mistake by turning against religion?
I'm not sure the left turned against religion. I think beginning in the 60s, there was a split, which continues between you know, more left-leaning religious people and most evangelicals and conservative Catholics who are very conservative, obviously. There's still religious left out there. There's the Interfaith Alliance, which does a lot on labor rights, people like Jim Wallace and others, but they are not as well organized. And obviously, from the polls, we can see that people who go to church on a regular basis tend to be Republicans, and people who don't go to church very much tend to be Democrats. But, you know, this is a split which has really been there since the 1960s and shows few signs of ending. I'm not sure the New Left in itself could have done a lot about that one way or the other. You know, the Supreme Court, of course, was under Earl Warren, was the great California governor, was doing a lot to try to promote a more secular, more tolerant way of understanding public institutions. But at the same time, that was going to alienate religious people.
I think one
of the things which is important, however, for people on the left, especially people who listen to this program probably, is to...
If there's anybody left.
The key thing is not whether one believes in God or not. The question, I think, as a pragmatist, philosophically, is what you do with that, what the consequences are of your beliefs. And from my point of view, though I'm not a religious person, an evangelical Protestant can, if they treat people well and promote... a more decent society can be just as good as a secular person, especially a secular person who, as you say, supports tyrants.
Well, just in closing, let's turn to the big issue, if you will, in your new book, American Dreamers: How the Left Changed a Nation. Michael Kazin, it is clear, and the book makes it clear that the left has transformed American society and the American soul, and had tremendous influence over American culture, which is why the right wing out here in Hollywood is so freaked out. All these untalented writers and directors on the right keep saying the reason they don't get work is because there's a left wing conspiracy in control. The same argument that Ayn Rand made when she was a screenwriter. But the long and the short of it is, you know, the cultural hegemony is on the left, clearly. Why have they been so unsuccessful since FDR in changing? They've changed the culture, but they haven't been able to change politics and economics. We don't have anything like what the Europeans have.
No, it's true. You know, well, you know, we've always had a, you know, sort of class ideology in this country that about the self-made man and more recently the self-made woman. And sometimes that's been true, sometimes it hasn't been true. But Americans tend to believe that if you work hard enough, you know, you can get ahead. And that, you know, is partly reality, partly myth. And that's very strong. But I think we shouldn't overdo the failure of the left politically. I mean, after all, we did get civil rights and voting rights acts. Same-sex marriage is on its way to being accepted, I think. Will be in the next 10 years, almost everywhere in the country, except perhaps in the most evangelical states. And women's rights is, of course, advanced to all those who were originally left-wing causes, even though now we think of them as pretty much, you know, liberal or even moderate causes. And of course, we just had King's birthday in the memorial, which was unveiled in Washington, D.C., and King, most people who listen to this program know, was basically a democratic socialist. And so even though he's been sanctified by everyone in the culture, you know, this was a man who actually wanted to change America in radical ways, and we still have that.
Since King has been has walked away from his positions, he was probably one of the last truly courageous guy. I guess I do like to talk often with Bernie Sanders as well. There's still people out there that are fighting the good fight. I thank you for joining us, Michael Kazin.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with historian Michael Kazin. He's a professor of history at Georgetown University, the author of a new book, American Dreamers, How the Left Changed the Nation. His other books include Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan, and The Populist Persuasion in American History. He also co-edits Dissent magazine and writes a column for The New Republic. So what did we learn today on Background Briefing? We began speaking with somebody who was recently in the administration. He was a senior advisor to President Obama's envoy for Pakistan and Afghanistan. He has a big op-ed piece in Sunday's New York Times, Vali Nasser, talking about the shifting political sands in the Arab Spring and warning that these revolutions of hope, as they topple tyrants, could also turn ugly as these cornered despots resort to stirring up sectarian strife. And he gave a series of examples and really drew out the Sunni-Shia divide in these various countries all the way from Pakistan across to Morocco. And particularly with these fault lines with Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, Bahrain, It's difficult not to think that things could really turn ugly on a dime. Then we spoke with Adele Stan, who's warning progressives about who Ron Paul really is: anti-woman, anti-gay, anti-black, anti-senior citizen, anti-equality, anti-education, etc. And she has quite an entertaining article at Alternet. And even though Ron Paul is a hero of a lot of people because of his anti-war, anti-empire stance, she's done us all, a favor by really getting into his record. He was the keynote speaker at the 50th anniversary of the John Birch Society, which, of course, was co-founded by the Koch brothers' father, not a very nice organization. So she actually gave a good accounting, I think. And then finally, historian Michael Kazin joined us to talk about his new book, American Dreamers. And it's a good time to talk about some of the refreshing history of the American left that transformed both American society and America's soul, had a profound effect on American culture, but has been a dismal failure in terms of making progress on political, social, and economic issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nasseter. This program's available for podcasting. You can sign up and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.